Welcome to the debate. You know, modern medicine is, it's pretty incredible when you think about it. We can literally pull a patient back from the brink of multi-organ failure.
Right, or sequence their entire DNA in, what, a matter of hours?
Exactly. We can replace a failing heart. Yet, we have this profound paradox today. A patient can have perfectly stable lab results. I mean, everything on paper looks great, but they might be completely unable to get out of bed.
Yeah, and our world-class medical system will have absolutely no idea why.
Right. So today, we're asking if modern internal medicine has, well, fundamentally misunderstood what it means to be alive. We are exploring a paradox articulated in Dr. Bikara Sahali's recent academic white paper. It's called Life Coherent Internal Medicine.
And the core of that paper, which is really the focus of our discourse today, is this idea that despite our unprecedented diagnostic power, the daily practice of medicine often fragments the patient, you know, into isolated organ systems or disease codes and laboratory values.
We fix the numbers, but the patient remains broken.
Right. So the central academic tension we are looking at is whether we need a massive philosophical revolution to solve that fragmentation. The paper proposes applying Humberto Maturana's biological theories, specifically concepts like autopoiesis and structural coupling, to provide a new, quote-unquote, deeper grammar for internal medicine.
Which I would argue is absolutely essential.
Well, and that's the debate, right? Does applying this framework rescue medicine from its own tunnel vision? Or does layering dense philosophical concepts like living unities over clinical practice risk diluting the very biomedical precision that actually saves lives? Because I definitely lean toward the latter.
And I am taking the position that this Maturana-informed framework is crucial for the future of the field. Right now, internal medicine operates without a coherent, unifying theory of the living patient. We just rely so heavily on memorized checklists.
Which are evidence-based checklists, to be fair.
They are, but look at how they are taught. If a patient presents with dyspnea, shortness of breath, medical students are taught to just run through a list of independent causes. Is it the lungs, the heart, the blood?
Sure. You isolate the system to find the pathology.
But Dr. Sahali's core thesis argues this is backward. We need to view the patient as an autonomous, living unity. And to understand that, we have to understand Maturana's concept of autopoiesis, which simply means self-creation. A living organism is constantly remaking itself to stay alive.
Okay, but how does that actually differ from basic homeostasis?
Because it operates through what is called structural coupling, meaning the organism and its environment are locked in a continuous dance. They are constantly changing each other. So the life coherent framework doesn't reject biomedicine, but it reorganizes all those facts around the life coherence criterion.
Right.
Health isn't just the absence of disease. It's the capacity for viable living. The ultimate goal isn't just normalizing a lab number. It's actively restoring a patient's capacity to participate in their own life, you know, with minimum harm.
Okay. And I will be representing the skeptical perspective on this proposal today, because I really have to push back right from the start. The fragmentation that this white paper so heavily criticizes is, in my view, the exact analytical precision necessary to treat complex pathology.
But at what cost to the whole person?
Well, I deeply value holistic care, obviously, but we do not operate in a vacuum. We already have robust models to address the whole patient. I mean, the biopsychosocial model has been around for decades.
Yeah, but it hasn't.
And we have whole person health initiatives, right? And competency-based frameworks like CanMeds. Those explicitly teach physicians to act as health advocates and communicators, not just cold scientists. We don't require a wholesale philosophical reinvention to tell us that the environment matters.
I hear that, but
furthermore, redefining acute physiological problems as abstract organism medium relations carries a massive risk. It threatens to overwhelm clinical reasoning. We really risk distracting clinicians from immediate evidence-based interventions in favor of broad, almost sociological theorizing.
I think the best way to understand why existing models like the biopsychosocial approach haven't solved the problem is to look at how this new philosophy actually changes bedside practice.
Okay, how so?
The paper translates Maturana's theories into a very specific clinical method. It's called the life coherent clinical loop. Currently, standard diagnostics often lead to endless harmful compensation management,
We put a patient on one drug, it causes a side effect.
We add another drug to manage the side effect.
Exactly. And the patient just spirals. To stop this, the life coherent loop moves sequentially through six specific steps. First, stabilize danger. Second, distinguish the syndrome. Third, locate the capacity failure.
Okay.
Fourth, map the coupling conditions. Fifth, initiate wise perturbation. And finally, observe the repair trajectory.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. The cognitive load of acute clinical medicine is already immense. When a patient crashes into the emergency department or, you know, starts deteriorating on the ward at 2 a.m, the physician needs rapid pattern recognition.
Which this doesn't replace.
But it adds to it. Conventional differential diagnosis is faster, and because it is faster, it is safer. If you are a resident dealing with an acutely hypotensive patient, and you have to start layering on philosophical requirements to define capacity failure and organism-medium coupling conditions.
Wait, no, that's a mischaracterization of the loop.
You risk slowing down your response time. Medicine is fundamentally a technical discipline of diagnosis and pharmacological intervention. We need a clear algorithmic line from symptom to diagnosis to treatment. This loop adds cognitive steps that, in a crisis, are a luxury we simply cannot afford.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Think about standard diagnostics as treating the human body like a car engine.
Okay, a car engine.
If the engine is sputtering, conventional medicine focuses entirely on finding the broken part, right? A frayed belt, a bad spark plug, and then replacing it. But structural coupling says you can't just look at the engine in isolation. You have to look at the fact that this specific car is being driven through corrosive salt water every single day.
The environment.
Yes, the environment is actively eroding the machine. You can keep replacing the spark plugs all you want, but until you understand the terrain, the vehicle will keep failing.
Now, to your point about the crashing patient.
Right, the hypotensive patient at 2 a.m.
Look directly at the text. The very first step of this loop is explicitly stabilize danger. The framework mandates the immediate recognition of acute threats. Sepsis, diabetic ketoacidosis, pulmonary embolism, stroke.
So it doesn't change the immediate emergency response.
No, it does not replace emergency pathways. If someone is hypoxemic, you give them oxygen. If they have a myocardial infarction, you reperfuse the heart. The cognitive load isn't replaced, it's sequenced. The framework ensures that once the danger is stabilized, the care doesn't stop at mere disease suppression.
But does it actually change the outcome or just the vocabulary? Because let's take your DKA example, diabetic ketoacidosis.
Sure.
Once the immediate danger of the acidosis is stabilized, conventional medicine still looks at the underlying cause. We don't just treat the DKA in the ICU and send them home blind. We manage the diabetes. We adjust the insulin regimen. We consult endocrinology. We educate the patient.
Right. We manage the numbers. Yes. We manage the HbA1c. But do we systematically map the coupling conditions as a core part of the physiology?
I mean, social workers do.
But physicians need to. Take a patient who keeps coming back in DKA. Standard medicine says they are non-compliant. The life coherent loop asks, what are the conditions in the patient's world that are conserving this failure?
You mean like their living situation?
Exactly. Perhaps they lost their job, or they lost their refrigeration for their insulin, or they are living in chronic stress that is driving up their cortisol and literally rendering the insulin less effective. The loop prevents us from pretending that prescribing a scientifically sound medication is a success if it's practically impossible for the living unity of the patient to implement it in their environment.
If you're listening right now and thinking, wait, how does a doctor in a 15-minute consult fix a patient's employment status or housing? You are hitting on my exact worry with this paper.
It's not about the doctor fixing the housing.
You argue we need to map the patient's environment, but how does external social friction, like job loss or poverty, actually translate into physical exhaustion or insulin resistance? Unless we can prove a biological mechanism that links the two, this is just sociology invading internal medicine.
That is the perfect transition, because to understand how the external environment physically breaks the internal machine, we have to look at how this paper views cellular function itself. It all comes down to the mitochondria.
the powerhouse of the cell.
Right. But the framework draws heavily on a concept from Liu and colleagues called mitoception. Simply put, mitochondria don't just produce energy. They act as cellular antennas, constantly sensing the environment.
Okay.
This distinction creates a massive shift in clinical reasoning. It's the difference between an energy deficit and an energy gap. An energy deficit is a lack of physical inputs. You have anemia, so you lack oxygen. You have iron deficiency, so you lack iron. The fuel simply isn't there.
Right, standard pathology.
But an energy gap is a failure of the mitochondria to transform available inputs into usable capacity.
So the fuel is there, the basic lab results are totally normal, but the engine still won't turn over.
Exactly. The labs are normal, but the demand exceeds the organism's energy transformation capacity. Why? Because when the brain perceives chronic external threats like poverty, trauma, or, you know, severe sleep deprivation, it sends neuroendocrine signals to the cells.
And the mitochondria react to that.
Yes. The mitochondria receive these signals and undergo a cell danger response. They literally shift their function away from producing ATP for daily living and instead use their resources for cellular defense and inflammation.
Interesting.
This is revolutionary because it protects patients from what the paper calls moral injury. Think of the multimorbid patient with profound fatigue whose doctor looks at perfectly normal blood work and says, "Your labs are fine, it must be depression, or you just need to exercise more."
Which happens constantly.
Right. The life coherent approach recognizes that the absence of a fuel deficit does not prove the presence of usable energy. It explains exactly how social stress physically shuts down cellular power.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered the profound risk of mitochondrial reductionism? Because the text explicitly warns against this, yet it heavily leans on it for its core arguments.
I wouldn't say it falls into reductionism.
But it kind of does. Attributing complex systemic fatigue, cognitive fog, or social overload to a mitochondrial energy gap stretches the biological science incredibly far. We are taking highly complex, multi-layered psychosocial phenomena and trying to anchor them all in the oxidative phosphorylation capacity of a single organelle.
But they are the translation site.
Even if the paper preaches wise perturbation, which it defines as careful, proportionate interventions, focusing so heavily on mitochondria might encourage incredibly speculative treatments. We already see this in wellness spaces today.
Well, yes, the supplement industry.
Exactly. Unproven supplements, IV drips, aggressive protocols, all designed to, quote, boost mitochondrial function without rigorous clinical trial data. If we anchor internal medicine here, we risk validating pseudoscience.
I disagree, because the framework explicitly guards against that. It argues that the mitochondrial lens does not justify indiscriminate supplementation. You can't just throw CoQ10 at a structural coupling problem.
Glad we agree on that.
Instead, it teaches the clinician to protect the conditions under which cellular repair can actually occur organically. It's about proportionality of intervention. Take exercise, for instance.
Okay.
Exercise is often prescribed broadly as a cure-all, but for a patient with an ongoing cell danger response or severe post-exertional malaise, excessive exertion widens that energy gap. You're asking cells in defense mode to suddenly act like they are in performance mode, and that worsens the collapse.
So you scale it back.
Right. The question the life-coherent clinician asks is, what exact dose of perturbation produces positive adaptation rather than further injury? It's not about reducing the entire human to a mitochondrion. It's acknowledging that the mitochondria are the critical translation sites. They are where sleep, movement, autonomic tone, and social stress are actually translated into biological capacity.
I hear the intent, I really do. But the leap from an organelle sensing stress to the physician managing that stress brings us to the most difficult part of this paper, how it handles the aging, multimorbid patient.
Which is the biggest challenge in medicine right now.
Let's look at the concept of frailty, which is a massive burden on modern healthcare.
This is exactly where standard organ system teaching truly fails us. A multimorbid patient isn't just a collection of unrelated diagnoses happening simultaneously. The paper takes the fried frailty phenotype, which includes markers like unintentional weight loss, self-reported exhaustion, weakness, slow walking speed.
Right, standard geriatric markers.
But traditionally, geriatricians treat these as inevitable, sometimes separate consequences of aging. Dr. Sally's framework redefines this entirely. It's not just a geriatric label. It is a multi-system collapse of adaptive reserve across what the paper calls capacity systems.
Okay, but how does that change the treatment?
It argues that this illness is conserved through those organism-medium relations we discussed. If an elderly patient is frail and their housing is unsafe or they face food insecurity, standard medicine treats those as unfortunate contexts outside our purview.
Because they are outside a physician's technical control.
But the life coherent model says those are the specific structural coupling conditions that are physically degrading their capacities. The framework expands the physician's role to a witness of the civil commons.
The civil commons being?
The public goods, clean water, safe housing, community support, the things humans require to maintain autopoiesis.
And this is exactly where the framework asks too much of the internist. Defining chronic illness as a biological ledger of social incoherence sounds beautifully poetic, but medicine is a specific technical discipline.
It's a biological discipline, and the social affects the biology.
But asking doctors to integrate civil commons failures like housing policy, food supply, institutional trust into bedside physiological reasoning blurs the line between public health and internal medicine. It risks completely paralyzing the clinician.
I don't think it paralyzes them. I think it informs them.
A doctor in a 15-minute consultation cannot fix the civil commons. They cannot build affordable housing. They can adjust a heart failure medication to keep fluid out of the lungs. If we demand they do both, or if we tell them that adjusting the medication is somehow a failure because the housing is still inadequate, we will accelerate clinician burnout, not cure it.
The framework isn't demanding the doctor fix the civil commons in 15 minutes. It's demanding the doctor stop pretending that the social isn't biological.
But we already know it's connected.
Do we? Structural coupling proves that recurrent perturbations from the environment literally change the physical structure of the organism. Treating that diabetic patient's HbA1c with the most advanced pharmaceuticals without mapping the coupling conditions, the poverty, the lack of access to fresh food, leads to interventions that are scientifically perfect but practically incoherent.
Okay, but
the doctor does not have to solve poverty. But if they prescribe a treatment plan that ignores it, they fail the patient entirely. Recognizing frailty as a systemic warning signal means realizing the patient's adaptive reserve can no longer absorb ordinary pharmacological shocks. It changes the prescription. It means maybe you don't add that fourth blood pressure medication because you realize their system doesn't have the capacity to metabolize the perturbation.
But we already know this. A good internist already knows not to prescribe an impossibly expensive medication to a patient who can't afford it, or to consider a patient's physical home environment before discharging them from the hospital.
Sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't.
But we don't call that life coherent structural coupling. We call it good clinical judgment. Do we really need to introduce terms like autopoiesis, structural coupling, and salogenesis, the origin of health, to describe what is essentially thorough, compassionate medical practice?
It gives us a shared language for it.
I worry deeply about medical education, though. Organizing a curriculum around 7 abstract primitives, living unity, clinical distinction, boundary exchange, and so on, will leave medical students without the rigorous algorithmic foundation they need to actually survive on the wards.
I disagree completely.
The text proposes teaching students generative distinctions rather than overwhelming them with facts. But the facts are what keep patients alive at 2 a.m. when the heart monitor starts alarming.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning because the paper addresses this pedagogical crisis head on. Look at what is happening to medical students right now.
They are definitely overwhelmed. I'll give you that.
Exactly. The current response to the explosion of medical complexity is compression. We force students to memorize endless lists, acronyms, and disease scripts. The result is brittle knowledge. A student can recite 10 independent causes of chest pain to pass a multiple choice board exam, right?
Yes.
But they lack a deeper understanding of chest pain as a unified disturbance in oxygenation or tissue injury or threat perception. The life coherent approach doesn't remove the facts. It gives them a grammar.
A grammar?
Yes. The student still learns the differential diagnosis for acute kidney injury, but they understand it within the capacity system of clearance and transformation. The framework explicitly states that the student-facing layer of this education must remain practical, bedside useful, and exam relevant.
But how does the question change for the student?
It shifts slightly. Instead of only asking what disease diagnosis explains this specific symptom, the student also learns to ask, why can this person no longer transform available conditions into usable life capacity? It creates a doctor who treats the whole unity, not just the failing kidney.
And I will readily concede that memorization without understanding is failing our students. We are producing doctors who are incredibly good at taking tests, but, well, they struggle with the gray areas of human suffering.
Which is where most of medicine happens.
Right. The paper rightly notes that multimorbidity is a massive clinical challenge, and that disease-specific guidelines often create competing priorities. You have guidelines for the heart, guidelines for the kidneys, and guidelines for the lungs.
And if you follow them all?
You end up with an incredible toxic medication burden for complex patients. I agree. Shifting the mindset from treat every disease maximally to restore the person's viable life as wisely as possible is a necessary correction.
So we agree on the goal.
We do, but I maintain that the traditional disease-focused biomedical model, with its strict organ system delineations, remains our most reliable tool for curing pathology. We must be incredibly careful not to let conceptual overlays blunt the precise edge of that tool. If we lose our strict biological focus in favor of observing the repair trajectory of the living unity, we might miss the subtle clinical signs of a deteriorating engine until it is too late.
To summarize my position on this fascinating text, I really believe life-coherent internal medicine offers a necessary and urgent paradigm shift. It takes the immense, scattered, overwhelming facts of modern biomedicine and organizes them around a set of primitives that prioritize one essential thing.
Which is?
Ease is a success if the patient's life remains structurally incoherent. By integrating Maturana's biology, it brings the observer, the patient, the mitochondria, and the civil commons into a single, unified biological reality. It gives internal medicine the unifying theory it desperately needs.
And my summary is that while treating the whole patient is the noble and ultimate goal of all medicine, we must fiercely protect the analytical rigor that got us here. The fragmentation of the body into distinct systems isn't a failure of philosophy. It is a triumph of reductionist science that has literally doubled the human lifespan.
But we can build on that.
We should absolutely refine our clinical reasoning to account for energy gaps and social realities. But a complete philosophical reorganization of physiology into capacity systems is a massive risk. We can achieve the holistic, patient-centered goals of this white paper by strengthening our existing biopsychosocial and competency frameworks without entirely rewriting the fundamental, precise language of internal medicine.
It is clear we share critical common ground in recognizing that modern medicine is currently staggering under the weight of multimorbidity and chronic disease. The old ways of operating are reaching their limits.
Oh, absolutely.
We both agree that handing a medical student a list of isolated facts without a unifying framework is an educational failure that leads to burnout and brittle care.
Yes, the convergence is absolutely there. The problem is universally recognized. We just remain deeply divided on whether adopting Humberto Maturana's biological theories of autopoiesis is the necessary remedy to save medicine, or if it is an abstract distraction from the hard work of clinical science.
And that is a debate that will surely continue as this provocative white paper works its way into medical curricula and academic symposiums. It challenges the very foundation of how a clinician looks at the human body. Think back to that car engine driving through the corrosive salt water.
Right.
Dr. Sahili's text forces clinicians to stand at the bedside and ask a profoundly challenging question, one that moves far beyond the isolated mechanics of the machine. Whether you fully adopt the Maturin Foundation or you stick strictly to traditional, targeted biomedicine, there is deep value in exploring this text to refine your own clinical reasoning.
It definitely forces you to think differently.
It does, because ultimately it leaves us with the only question that truly matters to the suffering person in the bed. What must be restored so that this person can live again?